Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. It's September 19th, 2013. This is Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Our theme tonight is life on the wire. It's a quote from Kurt Valinda. Someone used it in a meeting the other day when one of their teammates was worried about the risks involved in the action they were taking, and he posted a quote from the trapeze artist, "Life is on the wire. Everything is just waiting around." Anyway, it reminds me of Steve Jobs' once saying, real artists ship. But as the change accelerates, we're seeing, it feels like everything's being stretched tight like the wire, and we're all having to exercise what I would call jump the curve, which means we have to reach out of our comfort zone because change is upon us. Upcoming events, I'm going to be speaking at the Casey Summit, at the Casey Summit Conference, October 4th, 5th, and 6th, 2013. That's coming up in the beginning of next month. Then I'll be at Breakthrough Energy Movement in Colorado, October 10th to 12th, and I'll be speaking there on crowdfunding. And then we're going to have a lunch for subscribers on October 12th, that last day at the conference. And then San Francisco, I'll also be speaking at the end of the month, and we're going to have a lunch with Catherine that we'll post next week. I wanted to mention again, we're going to a pre-record format. We've worked very hard to try and keep doing the live sessions, but we really cannot ensure quality recording for subscribers, and I think it's really important that you have that. We've created an email address at askcatherine@soleri.com to make sure you can get your questions in, and I certainly love doing them live and having a live audience. At the same time, as I travel around, I'm just finding tremendous deterioration in the reliability of the telecommunications. And so we want to assure a certain quality for you. And we think the pre-record will work much better. Money and markets. The big story, of course, was the Fed surprised Wall Street and me. I thought we were going to see a reduction in the amount of bond buying they're doing every month, $85 billion. I was expecting a reduction of about $10 to $15 billion a month. Sure enough, no taper. Now, the headline this morning on Yahoo Finance was Ben sticks to his plan. And of course, if you look at the targets that Bernanke said that he wanted for the unemployment rate and some of the other targets, in fact, he is sticking to the plan. Now, he had tried to jawbone earlier this year saying that the Fed was going to taper because they need to. And so the market expected a little bit of tapering, but I think Bernanke took a look at the employment numbers. In many parts of the country, it feels like the economy has literally stopped. I think the Fed just stuck to the plan that they had announced. But it was a surprise for Wall Street. It was a surprise for yours truly. The markets were up a lot, and part of the reason was Larry Summers withdrew his name from the Fed from consideration for the chairmanship. And I think many people, including me, breathed a sigh of relief. Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, I believe the architect of the gold suppression plan, and had been a senior White House economic advisor. And I simply think the association of Summers with leading and engineering the financial coup d'etat is really more than the country could bear. So it looks like we're going to have Fed Governor Yellen, who certainly will bring consistency to the job. One of the things that happened with the interest rates down and stock market up is the emerging markets, which have been quite in the doldrum, look more attractive. Sure enough, we've seen lots of market commentators advising everyone to get out of bonds in Asia, but we see KKR announcing a private debt fund for India and Asia. So just as retail is out there getting in, the sun mysteriously goes all quiet, sunspots dropping to very low levels, always an ominous sign for the stock market. I put the article up on the blog. The pushback on Syria is enormous. We see the Americans pushing hard for military action in Syria, and the pushback tremendous from around the globe, with Russia really leading the way in trying to prevent it. And really what we're seeing is sort of an oil card and market share game playing out in the Middle East. The Economist announces, publishes a story on the, they called it the Weakened West, pointing out that the way this game has played out has really hurt America, or certainly America's position. And certainly the Chinese and Russians are looking stronger in terms of Middle East energy. There's no doubt about it. Russia today calls UN chemical report on Syria biased, and Putin points out that he's planning on seeking a fourth presidential term, which is his way of saying, you know, you're going to have to deal with me for 25 years. Where's the president's turnover? Of course, part of the pushback is more articles pointing out that Israel has 80 nukes. So what are we worried about? You know, by far and away, they're the nuclear problem in the Middle East. We see a shooting at the Navy Yard. I suspect it's probably related because the controversy and debate within the leadership, including at the high levels of the military, and certainly the Navy being the most powerful part of the military, were significant. It wouldn't surprise me if that's connected. But it's one of those situations where you look at it and you say, there's a story here, but it's going to take me many, many hours to try and figure out, and we're probably not going to be able to do it. The backdrop on Syria, of course, is enormous divergence of resources going on around the world and including in the United States. We see new reports that the U.S. super rich have hit a new wealth record 5 years after the financial crisis, and that, you know, everybody else is going in the opposite direction. So we're really seeing that divide. New studies, again, up on the blog, show that government workers are downsizing. So government is no longer picking up the slack. It's going the other way. MIT Technology Review, very interesting report that suggests half of U.S. jobs are vulnerable to computerization. So, and that really underscores the kind of change that's accelerating. George Ure had an interesting debate on his website, Urban Survival, because he proposed taxes and Social Security and payroll taxes for every job taken away by the robotics. The idea being the robot should put money into Social Security. It's not a bad idea. But it's very interesting to see the pushback he got. One smart guy in response to the kind of jump the curve situation that we're looking at in terms of income and employment, the mayor of Rockford, Illinois, tweeted Etsy's CEO and is now trying to create a partnership with Etsy, Etsy being a leading website on craft entrepreneurship. Meantime, part of this divergence is that the cash is piling up at large corporations, and we're seeing almost, it's approaching $2 trillion of cash sitting at the big corporations. We see an article that I posted up on the blog in the Wall Street Journal this week, companies unplugging from the electric grid, delivering a jolt to utilities. As more and more companies pile up cash and can't find ways of investing it, what they're going to do is they're going to re-engineer their balance sheets to deflate their expenses. And that's exactly what we should be doing too. Don't be afraid to see what you can do for yourself or how you can re-engineer your energy costs by doing more for yourself. But utilities and businesses like it are really in for surprise competition from people who are looking to integrate in whole new ways down through their balance sheet and income statement. Very important continuing dynamic. It's much bigger than a story. It's an enormous dynamic. It's the fallout from the NSA continuing revelations. The BRICS in particular don't want that divergence that's been happening to us in the United States to happen to them. Make no mistake about it. A significant reason for the significant divergence in income is the fact that we're in front of the one-way mirror, and you have a very small group of people in society with access to the intelligence that can be harvested off an NSA platform with defense contractors being able to read, see and hear everything that everybody says and does over the digital networks. I had one great ally say, there's no way they could watch more than 20,000 people. No, with computers and artificial intelligence, they can harvest economic knowledge and influence at a household level, economic activity, It's quite extraordinary, the machinery they've built. And the BRICS don't want that divergence of income to happen to them. They want to avoid what's been happening to us. And so a big blog post I have up on the effort for the BRICS to come up with an independent internet cable that cannot be harvested by the U.S. Or the Anglo-American intelligence agencies. We saw another story on a Belgian telco saying it was hacked, with reports pointing to NSA or their friends as the problem. Again, I'm going to keep following this story, and I talk a lot about it in crowdfunding, because as the financial flows move out into the internet, whether it's payment systems, whether it's security transactions, whether it's currency and digital currency, the fight over who controls and who has access to what and where the American one-way mirror goes and who has access to that intelligence is going to be an incredibly important variable in the economy. I talk about in the crowdfunding interview the importance of maintaining privacy. If somebody's funding you, but through the back door they have access to all the information on all of your inventions before you get to file the patents or you get to sell the company, it's a whole different kettle of fish. So this issue of who has access to what on the internet and the balkanization of the internet as different sovereign nations and networks try to protect themselves from this kind of invasive force is just going to continue. Twitter files for, believe it or not, a private filing under the Jobs Act, which we're going to be talking about because it was the Jobs Act that authorized crowdfunding. But it was Bloomberg noted that Twitter filing a private filing seeking secrecy was an interesting thing for a business that thrives on excessive sharing to do. Financial shenanigans. J.P. Morgan just settled today, $920 million payout to try and settle the London Whale scandal. J.P. Morgan Chase has been under a lot of fire recently, and it's always interesting to watch, because one thing to remember when you watch these kind of headlines is J.P. Morgan Chase and the big financial institutions, both as contractor, servicer, have many, many very intimate and significant roles on behalf of the federal government and as depository for the federal government. And as long as you don't see them fired from those roles or those contracts and relationship canceled, all these little squabbles are really about J.P. Morgan Chase kickbacking a percentage of the profits into the enforcers, and that's one of the ways they get their budget covered. So until you see them fired from the critical and intimate roles that give them access to information, give them access to trading with the federal credit and lots of other things, don't assume that they're getting beat up on too hard. Great concern over Obamacare. The polls are not in favor of Obamacare or a lot of the provisions thereof. We see the House GOP trying to finance or trying to tie new budgets and government funding to the health law. Meantime, we see corporations continuing to shift their health plans in ways that I think are not in the interest of their employees. And so we're really watching Obamacare turn into what I have always predicted it was, part of lowering the boom on the legacy systems in a way that's not going to be in favor of the American people. Our hero tonight is Alexander Hamilton, who was the first Secretary of the Treasury and was, to me, the chief design of the Constitution of the United States. He was the organizer and leader of literally an editorial campaign, which became the Federalist Papers, was the most vocal arguer to ban slavery within the Constitution. And, of course, it took many years later to the Civil War to do it. Alexander Hamilton was also a defender of the public debt. He was as the Secretary of Treasury, he was the one who argued that the U.S. government should honor its debts issued to finance the war. And I think the decision to do that, which of course made a whole lot of arbitrageurs rich who bought the paper up for pennies on the dollar, was critical to establishing the federal credit. He wrote several eloquent pieces on sort of arguing on behalf of integrity in the federal credit. And I bring up his name. When I was in the Bush administration, I used to constantly find myself defending the integrity of our credits up against a series of different political appointees who wanted to abrogate our contracts and abrogate our deals. And I would always leave the meetings dejected because the corruption was such a deeply imbued characteristic of life at HUD at that point. And I had a deputy who used to say, "Don't worry, Alexander Hamilton already had this fight, and Alexander Hamilton won." And it was one of the reasons when I created my company in Washington, I named it after Hamilton, Hamilton Securities. The reason I wanted to mention Hamilton was not only has he always been a particular hero of mine, but I think the most important thing we need to create a environment where we can start to do the kind of transactions and investments that are really going to revitalize and rebuild the household and community economy and help what I call reinvent the heartland into the digital heartland, integrate new technology, and do things like the crowdfunding that we talk about in the interview. What we need is we need to have a culture where we respect and honor our covenants and contracts with each other. And that's a culture that has really not been present in America. Inside the matrix, inside the tapeworm, we see force standing behind contracts. But for those who've tried to go outside, it's very important to find and create that culture, and it's been lacking. And so when you think about how we can create alternative solutions and how we can start to shift our money into ways that start to rebuild the economy, think about how you and those around you can have integrity in terms of our contracts and our agreements, because that is one of the most important conditions precedent to real change. And I think Hamilton's insistence on that integrity helped facilitate the success of change once upon a time after the Revolutionary War. Ask Catherine, "Dear Soleri, why is it so often after a precious metals market report from Franklin Sanders, something wild happens in the precious metals market within the next 24 hours? Yeah, sure enough, that's happened several times this year. I have no answer for it. I can assure you the precious metals market has a mind of its own, and so anything can happen. But yes, that has happened several times. You have mentioned a number of times that $50 trillion in assets have been transferred from the legacy economy into the new breakaway economy. Can you mention more specifically the different ways in which this is transferred has happened, who specifically the people are who are getting this money into their hands, and how, in your opinion, this money will now be utilized?" I think there have been a number of different ways. I've talked extensively about them on the Soleri Report and written about them. I think the number one method was mortgage fraud, and that included not just mortgage securities, but derivatives, and that levered the laundering of a lot of narcotics trafficking and sort of illegal money. So a combination of narco dollars, mortgage fraud, and the derivatives on top, I think, was a very big source. I think missing money from the United States government and some of the laundering of that money levered the mortgage fraud. And the next one, which is securities fraud, including the telco pump and dump that we saw sort of burst in 2000. So that was internet stocks and telcos draining out, among other things, tremendous amounts of money from pension funds. Then I think the NSA machinery, this sort of one-way mirror, has been instrumental to harvesting and insider trading lots of small business and lots of individuals, not just here, but around the world. And finally, there are a series of other smaller ones. But if you go back into our articles page and you take a look, I would particularly encourage you to read the Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, because many of these different methods have been levered with government contracts and rigging government rules in a way that helps private parties pool capital. And Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits was a way that I basically walked through a case study so you could understand that building block. So think of this as the joy of cooking. There are thousands of recipes, and I think amount of money that's been moved over with the financial coup d'etat has been very significant. If you want to keep reading, another good one to read is The Myth of the Rule of Law, which I published with a money management firm in London in the early 2000s. Something that where would the money be utilized? If you listen to the Farrell interview and the crowdfunding interviews, I describe that. I think it will be used to integrate new technology and build out what I'm calling the digital heartland. And I think a great deal of that investment has gone into invisible weaponry and the black budget. And I also think now we're going to build out a significant investment into space. So I think whether black budget, digital heartland, or space, we're going to start seeing a very significant rollout of investments. And I would encourage you to listen to the Farrell and crowdfunding to hear a little bit more about that. Something that I would find very valuable for Catherine to cover on the Solaria interview would be to interview someone who can tell us specific jobs or businesses they believe will be expanding in the coming years. Great idea. Thank you. I'm going to be looking for someone to do that. In your opinion, what is the Fed trying to accomplish by constantly telling us that they're going to end quantitative easing and then constantly reversing themselves? I don't really think they did reverse themselves. I think they know they would like to taper. I think when Bernanke talked about tapering, he was trying to get the market ready for tapering. I think they looked at the numbers up against their targets and said, okay, it doesn't make sense to taper yet. A question from Michael in Washington, who's got a regulated business under the new Washington rules allowing cannabis businesses to go forward. He wants to know, can crowdfunding make a source of capital for these highly regulated sectors? And points out that currently crowdfunding is requiring a verifiable investor. I would note that the rules related to verifiable investors I find deeply invasive and uncomfortable, and it's one of the reasons that people may not go with crowdfunding. They may pick one of the other exemption pathways. I had attorney Carolyn Betts write a wonderful piece on the different pathways of exemption in addition to crowdfunding that is up on the blog, and a link to the blog post for this Solaria report. And just remember, we don't have the regulations on crowdfunding yet, so we don't know what it will look like. I suspect that if the regulations do not make it comfortable for highly regulated sectors to do crowdfunding coming out of the bat, I think all over time it will be adapted. So yes, my expectation is probably, but take a look at those five other pathways, because there could easily be another exemption which is going to be a lot more comfortable for you. Great question about how we get a popsicle index for the sub-Saharan Africa community. I think that's a wonderful idea. I'm going to be thinking about it. I encourage everyone else to do it. The popsicle index is, you know, popsicles is a very uniquely American phenomenon. In Europe, they generally have no idea what a popsicle is, even though the name popsicle is owned by a European food company. So I do think it would be good to come up with sort of other indexes that not only allow us to look at the well-being of the living capital within a place, but in a way where the people in that place control their estimation or their calculation of the index, as opposed to academic experts who are funded by bankers. And that was one of the driving forces behind the Popsicle Index. Catherine, thank you for your providing excellent reports on financial, political, and economic matters. I have a question. How safe are Series I bonds as an investment right now? Good question. I think right now the federal credit is a reasonably safe place to be if you can print money to replace, to replace or refinance, then you really have no problem. The real issue is purchasing power. Of course, to me, the big issue, of course, is interest rates. If interest rates are headed up, you do not want to have long maturity. So I think the federal credit is safe for now, but interest rates makes being in anything other than short maturities very uncomfortable. And as that situation continues, we're going to see more and more people literally say, you know, I'd rather be in a good dividend yielding stock or real estate investment than in bonds. I'd rather live with the volatility than have to suffer rising interest rates. question in regard to why are Glenn Greenwald and Charlie Rose so lucky, which is an article up on commentary that we published last week that I wrote. I think one of the reasons that Glenn Greenwald and Charlie Rose have been able to publish things that are extremely critical of the NSA or the Syria policy is because we have very powerful and important players behind the scenes protecting them and allowing them to do so. And one of my votes for those players is the Vatican. I talk a little bit more about that with in the crowdfunding interview in the first part of that, which is the big picture. I just heard your discussion with Franklin about Amazon as one of the only sources of used books online. There's another great one, Abe Books. It used to be Advanced Book Exchange, I think. It has listings from booksellers around the world and lists millions of books. Great tip. Thank you very much. AbeBooks.com. I'm going to go check it out and start to use it. Thank you. Too late for Franklin's discussion, so maybe you and Chuck can touch on inflation. We're going to try and do that. It's a joy to know some photos by Soleri artists. We try and find photos and graphic from Soleri network artists. So if you're a Soleri artist, please keep sending them in. We love to have them. Okay, our interview is on crowdfunding. It's divided in two parts. The first part is on the bigger picture. There was an interview in Yahoo. I talk about it in our crowdfunding interview. It was up on Yahoo 2 days ago, and I took a snapshot when I took it. It said, what's better for society if the wealthy give money to charities, to taxes, to create business? The poll when I took it said 10% said give money to charities, 28% said give money or pay money for taxes, 62% said help create businesses. And I think that's a very important signal because that's sort of my experience with the general population. I think there's a real recognition that we have cash piling up among the wealthy and cash piling up among corporations, and they're struggling to find investment opportunities. And one of the reasons is we've used criminal means and government rigging and wasted a huge amount of government resources to kind of implode and harvest the general population. And now we're staring at a situation and say, what are we going to do? And there's no doubt about it that for many, many decades, we've had an enormous demand for small business investment and liquidity within small business equity. And that dam is finally about to break. So I talk about the fundamental economics behind it and then the extent to which I see there's being an enormous political agenda coming top down to try and channel that economic demand in ways that serve the leadership and the wealthy. And so the first part of the interview is the longer one because it's so important to me that you see the game, particularly if crowdfunding is something that you're going to participate in as an entrepreneur and an investor. And then the second part of the interview, which we've divided into a second audio, is to look at things from the point of view of the investor or the entrepreneur. What does it mean to you? We've spent a great deal of time. We have extensive resources in the subscriber part of the blog post because the discussion draws on many of the different things we've done. So I'm hoping this is a whole resource center for people who are going to be considering using crowdfunding or consider investing in it. And I think if I could say one thing, this is going to be a very significant shift of capital. And it's one where I expect every person listening to this call is going to, and listening to this recording is going to be approached by multiple people in your family, your friends, your network, and your community. And many of you will see opportunities to not just invest, but start to create the kind of capacity we want and need in areas like building a fresh food supply locally. So this is going to be, as Ed Sullivan used to say, this is going to be really, really big. Our movie tonight is in Let's Go to the Movies is The Startup Kid, which is a wonderful little documentary put together by two Icelandic entrepreneurs who started their own company after the crash in 2008 and then decided to travel around the world and talk to other young web entrepreneurs in the hopes of inspiring them to start their own companies. And it's really a delightful delightful documentary, and it talks about the many of the thrills and the perils of starting your own company. So check it out, Startup Kids. The trailer is in the blog post. Okay, that's it for this evening. In closing, just remember, we've got John Rappaport coming up next week, September 26th. Then I do the quarterly wrap-up on October 3rd. I'm going to be speaking to you from the KC conference out in Arizona. If there are things you want me to cover up, how do you like that? If there are things you want me to cover in the wrap-up, please let me know. And so if there are things you don't want me to talk about, please let me know. That's our chance to sit back and look at the primary trends and how we're doing up against the primary trends. October 10th, a very exciting one. It's our coming clean for the month. It's a beginner's guide to 3D printing, and I have a wonderful engineer who helps me with reviewing and researching innovation in different industries, and I think you're really going to find that to be helpful as you watch this explosion of interest in articles on 3D printing. So until I talk to you again with a wrap-up on October 3rd, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. Okay, welcome to the Saleri Report discussion on crowdfunding. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm delighted you could join us for this interview. It's an important one. I'm joined by a member of the Saleri team who you've not met yet, John Bondarek, who is a private investor and one of the people I turn to when I'm trying to figure out something new and important. So John and I are known to conspire about what in the world is really going on. So John, welcome to the Saleri Report.
Hi, Catherine.
Okay, crowdfunding. We have a blog post for the Saleri Report, and then we've also put up an article on the different pathways for financing a startup or a small company. And crowdfunding is expected to be a sixth pathway. We counted five pathways currently existing. If you're interested, I encourage you to look at that special Saleri Report. Crowdfunding is expected to be the sixth, or crowdfunding for equity and securities is expected to be the sixth when the Securities and Exchange Commission promulgate regulations expected this fall. Let me read a definition of crowdfunding to you from the Wikipedia, which I think is a very good one. Crowdfunding is the collective effort of individuals who network and pool their money, usually via the internet, to support efforts initiated by other people or organizations. Crowdfunding is used in support of a wide variety of activities, including disaster relief, journalism, support of artists by fans, political campaigns, startup company funding, motion picture promotion, free software development, invention development, scientific research, and civic projects. Crowdfunding can also refer to the funding of a company by selling small amounts of equity to many investors. This form of crowdfunding has recently received attention from policymakers in the United States with direct mention in the Jobs Act, legislation that allows for a wider pool of smaller investors with fewer restrictions. So essentially, crowdfunding, we started to talk about crowdfunding on the Saleri Report several years ago when a series of different websites, the most famous of which is Kickstarter, started to facilitate donations for projects of many kind, particularly for their focus was artists. And literally in 3 years' time, crowdfunding has exploded. And the example I always like to use, John, is the fact that 3 years ago when Kickstarter got going, the National Endowment of the Arts, I think the number was, gave $167 million in donations to artists. And 3 years later, they gave, I think, $147 million. Their appropriations have been cut. And Kickstarter facilitated $260 million coming from 2.2 million people. So by the internet and technology allowing millions of people to give tiny amounts of money in very efficient ways, we now are watching collective individuals blow by the National Endowment of the Arts as a source of funding for artists. It's kind of the just do it method. So Kickstarter and the donation kind of crowdfunding got a lot of interest in this. Another thing that encouraged a lot of interest was Kiva and other websites that facilitated non-interest-bearing loans. So I've been, I think at this point, in about 10 or 20 syndicates of people loaning money to entrepreneurs all around the world, tiny, tiny amounts of money. I remember I had a client during 2008, during the fiscal crisis, and she was trying to buy a Swiss bond, and the interest rates had turned negative. And so I touched base with her the next day, and I said, "What did you do?" And she said, "I just went to Kiva and made a lot of loans, because at least I know from those people I'll get it back." Anyway, I also, just as a way of introduction, yesterday I was on Yahoo Finance, and they had a poll on what's better for society, and I put it up in a commentary this week on the blog, but I wanted to read it. The question was, what's better for society? And you have three choices. If the wealthy give money to charities, if the wealthy pay more taxes, or if the wealthy give money to help create businesses. Okay? And 10% said if the wealthy give money to charities, 28% said if the wealthy pay more taxes, and 62% say if the wealthy give money to help create businesses. Okay? So startups are significantly ahead against the government and charities as a way to circulate wealth. So with that, let me just say, I want to talk in this first hour, I want to talk about crowdfunding at the macro level. What is crowdfunding? Why is it happening now? And what is it going to do in the broader economy, both in North America and globally? And I want to divide this discussion in two sections. One is fundamental economic trends, and then why is the political leadership pushing this? Because there is very much, I perceive, a top-down agenda here. And so we have tremendous fundamental economic forces pushing for crowdfunding, and at the same time we have a political agenda. And the two are meeting to create, you know, this hybrid that will go forward when the SEC finally lets it out of the SEC trap. After I finish covering the sort of macro view, then John and I are also going to record a little discussion on what does this mean to the individual entrepreneur and what does this mean to the individual investor. I think it's very important if you are a potential investor or you're a potential entrepreneur or just a member of a network or community where this is going to be happening, it's extremely important that you see the game. Because we're talking about surfing an enormous wave, and if you can't see the wave, instead of surfing it, you could get drowned. Is that?
I think that's fair.
That's fair. Okay. So let's start. We're going to talk from the macro perspective about fundamental economic trends, and I think why I think there's an enormous pent-up market demand for something like crowdfunding, and then we'll talk about the top-down agenda. Okay, well, I've listed out 9 or 10 reasons why I think there's a very powerful fundamental economic trend. So do you want to say anything before I jump in, or should I?
No, go right ahead.
Okay. So the first thing is, right now, capital, think of capital as a plumbing system, as a hydraulic system that organizes and sends waters into a series of pipes and pools. And right now, if you look at capital is collected up in communities throughout North America. And in the United States, that capital goes into Wall Street. And then it comes back around and comes out to companies around the country. So it's very centralized. And if you look at the amounts of money that have to sort of be aggregated to go through that pipe, it's very large. So you'll talk to certain institutional investors. They don't want to look at a deal less than $50 million. They have too much money to allocate. So by centralizing the financial system, you are aggregating money into pools that are relatively large. Now, it's interesting. When they passed the Jobs Act of 2012, which is what authorized crowdfunding to be used for equity securities in the United States, once the regulations are promulgated, when they passed the Job Act, one of the authors on a crowdfunding book went into one of the most common databases of all the businesses in the United States and said, how many companies of the Of the total, I think 26 million companies in the United States, how many are eligible to use this small business exemption? It applies to businesses with, I think, $1 billion of revenues or less. How many are eligible? Well, it was 90%. Okay. So we're talking about 90% of the businesses are generally too small to go through Wall Street. You know, maybe it's a little bit less if you, because a billion's a lot, but, you know, say 80%. But you're talking about most of the businesses in this country are not eligible to tap into the Wall Street pools. As a result, they are completely dependent on bank credit. And one of the things we've seen in cycle after cycle is we go through a slowdown in the economy, the bank credit stops, and those small businesses are starved, which makes it possible for the big businesses to move in and take over the market share. Okay. And that's what we saw, for example, at the end of the last housing bubble. You know, the bank and the credit markets crashed, but the stock market went up and the big companies had a field day buying. And that's when you saw the big franchises really move in and take over local market shares. So Wall Street deals in a certain size, but if you look at the small business market and how much small business income there is, including how many startups want to happen and could potentially create income, that's an enormous amount of revenue and income flow. And that income flow wants access to equity capital and ultimately to liquid equity capital. You know, one of the things I was working on in the 90s, as you know, was doing venture funds and stock exchanges for communities. You know, there's no reason not to have that, particularly now that the transaction fees are dropping dramatically with all these new internet payment systems. So Wall Street deals in a certain size, and what's happening is the technology is bringing the transaction costs and the communication possibilities, you know, they're making it very robust and very inexpensive. And there's no way to hold back that dam. You know, the plumbing system is trying to hold back that huge demand, 90% of the economy back in these pools, not letting it through the pipes, and it, you know, it's about to explode through the whole pool. So Wall Street deals in a certain size, and the demand to go lower into the micro world is just too big. Okay. Let me talk about a second thing, and that is alienation. We've had a period in the financial system, including the 2008 bailouts and what I call the financial coup d'etat, which has completely alienated an enormous number of people within the system. You'll see people say, look, you know, I'm not investing in a brokerage system. I'm not putting my money in a brokerage account because they're all liars. Now, I believe that's a little extreme because I don't think they're all liars. But the reality is the corruption has been so bad. And, you know, the facts of the matter are we've had a financial coup d'etat, which was engineers using fraud, and fraud was a matter of state policy at the highest levels of government and Wall Street, and everybody knows this. And so what you're seeing is a kind of psychological and spiritual walk away, saying, you know, I would rather invest in my family, I would rather invest in people I know, I would rather invest in myself, you know, I've had it with those folks. And nowhere is that more powerful, in my experience, than the millennials, the younger generation. Okay. The younger generation values their time, and they know that this system is harvesting them. They can see it. They can feel it. They may not understand the details of it, but the millennials have just a complete lack of trust. And so I think that makes it, you know, even more powerful that you have this demand for vehicles to exchange financial support. And that's why I think the donations took off, because people said, look, you know, rather than put my money in the brokerage account, I'd just rather give it to artists. I do that all the time. You know, I'd rather just give it to that artist and see that documentary on banjos made than... anyway, but in the Solari model, you know, our model basically says that an investment has two returns. It has a return to the investor, and it has a return to the network. and the combination is a positive total return. And traditionally, you know, when I went to Wharton Business School, what they taught me was all investments had to have a positive return to investor, or your intention was to achieve a positive return to investor. What I found, however, is that it is very important as an investor to try and understand the return to the network of any investment and to use that knowledge strategically to find opportunities and reduce risk. And what I found over many years is if everybody understands that you're someone who always tries to create a positive, you know, only play within the space of positive return to the network, you have a lot of tremendous brand and advantages, you know, in your life and in the marketplace. And I added, you know, we add a rule that I wasn't taught at Wharton Business School, which is do no harm. So my philosophy says always try and optimize return to investors subject to one rule. Never intentionally do something that has a negative return to the network, because that's going to create problems and risks down the road. Now, you know, it's very interesting. Following that system is how I've always found the great primary trends that have worked for me as an investor, number one. And number two, it's always helped me avoid things like Enron. You know, I kept looking at Enron and saying, I don't understand how it adds value. I can't fathom, you know, the only thing I can tell about Enron is it's having a negative impact on the network here, and I can't figure out where its business creates any fundamental economic value. It was very interesting, you know, when Goldman Sachs was indicted by the Department of Justice, or they brought the suit over their sort of fraudulent mortgage deals, even Bill Clinton during an interview said, you know, the big problem with that deal was not that it was fraudulent. The big deal problem with that deal is it served no fundamental economic purpose. So even, you know, it had gotten bad enough that you have Bill Clinton pointing that out about Goldman Sachs, which is, you know, his son-in-law works at Goldman Sachs. So we have a generation of people who intuitively understand that if everything you do shrinks the pie, there will be no pie for anybody. And they intuitively understand that they want to be part of something that makes the pie bigger.
Perfect.
Okay. Now, you know, that's how a market economy is supposed to work if you don't have huge amounts of government money and intervention and all these silly games. So, but deep down inside, they know that for something to be sustainable, it has to contribute to a bigger pie. And they want nothing to do with systems that don't get that. You know, and you'll talk to them about Wall Street and they'll say, those guys just don't get it. You know, they just don't get it. So that's a very big change in framework. And I think it's having a very profound impact on the economy in a very quiet way. Okay. So any questions before I leave alienation?
That's perfect.
John's being very quiet tonight. Okay. Align financial ecosystem with a living system. Part of wanting to have things have a positive total return is I think many people understand, they look around at what's happening in our environmental ecosystem. You know, they look at what's happening in the skies, they look at what's happening to the trees and the landscape, they look at what's happening to the animals, and it's very disturbing. The environmental pollution has grown tremendously. And they don't necessarily understand that one of the reasons this is happening is that their financial ecosystem is out of alignment with their living systems. But they have a very powerful hunger to get them into alignment, and understanding why you can't get into alignment, because intuitively they know that if you could get them into alignment, then everybody can make money from making places healthy, which you can. You can literally generate enormous amounts of equity capital gains from increasing the health of a place. You know, I always get very furious when people say to me, oh, you know, because of what's happening environmentally, we have to reduce consumption and that will destroy the stock market and be very bad. You know, financially, we need to improve consumption. That's hooey. If you finance places on a equity basis, then you can generate enormous capital gains in the equity markets, both private equity and public equity, by reducing consumption. Okay, so imagine the more you reduce in consumption and the more you save the environment, the more the Dow Jones goes up. So that's very, very possible. And I think one of the hungers in the body politic or the body investment is let's start organizing our investments by place so that we can optimize the living systems. You know, that wants to happen. And now with the internet and information technology, you know, it's information technology lets you see that. It lets you deal with the complexity and break it down and work by crowds with it. And so, you know, I think there's a tremendous ability now to see through the government rigging behind the scenes and see through that and move towards, okay, how do we optimize places? I noticed Nashville just came out with the ETF for Nashville.
The city of Nashville.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to go, you know, go long Zurich and short New York. Trading places. Okay. Ready for the next one?
Go.
Okay. New technology is decentralizing. It's always amazing for me to watch digital technology being used to centralize, because if you look at how technology should work, if anything, it should decentralize. It should make it possible for a little company to aggregate with other little companies to create powerful back offices to compete and do business with people in Shanghai. So it should be very decentralizing. And the reason it hasn't been is we've literally seen two things. We've literally seen enormous financial intervention on behalf of the large entity. The theory being if the big American companies can aggregate all the market here, then they can outcompete the big guys on the other side of the world. So that's part of it. But the other is we've literally seen covert force used to ensure that the flow moved into the big companies. So you know, I'm always talking about you have a group of people who have the ability to kill with impunity. So you have certain players who have central bank and government money and are free to act above the law. And that's what's caused the centralization. Technology should be very, very decentralizing. And of course, what we have in terms of fundamental demand is thousands of entrepreneurs seeing that opportunity and wanting to exercise it. So whether it's an entrepreneur who takes the new fabrication technology and says, you know, we can manufacture in our community. We don't need to ship manufactured goods from China. You know, it's funny because I live in a community, and many people do in America, where Walmart is wiped out the small businesses. Well, now the little entrepreneurs are going to be able to get 3D printers and fabrication technology and completely outcompete Walmart, who's bringing in goods from China, because they can just print it off their 3D printer. Who needs to go down to Walmart for a plastic toy? Just go next door and print one off.
That's pretty optimistic.
The economics are going to be there. So the question is, there's a very powerful desire in the fundamental economy to have that decentralization happen. Okay, and to give you a sense, my next point is related to that, to give you a sense of how powerful it is. When I was when I left the Bush administration and started Hamilton Securities Group in Washington, I discovered the internet and I discovered relational databases. And so I thought this was incredibly powerful, because you would be able to so increase the learning metabolism within a place that you could do all of the kind of things I think we'll be able to do with crowdfunding. I had my best, smartest banker, who had a PhD from MIT, was really brilliant. And I asked him to go off and simulate. We had databases of all the real estate, or many of the real estate transactions and places and real estate valuations, because we were serving as the lead financial advisor to the Federal Housing Administration and had access to just a treasure trove of data. And we were building a software tool called Community Wizard that collected up and aggregated and looked at all the economic data by place. And so we were able to do remarkable simulations of how much the small business income was and the small real estate and the small farms, and what it would look like if you could finance with equity and liquid equity, what would happen. And Henry came back after the first simulation, and he showed the capitalization of publicly traded stocks in the United States increasing by a multiple of 600%, six times, in a relatively, I think it was a 10-year period, a relatively short period. The numbers were so enormous, I just didn't believe them. I just said, Henry, you've made a mistake here. Go back. Do it again. And he kept coming back. And finally he said, look, you've got to look at this. I'm right. And I looked at the numbers. And, of course, this was before I understood anything about new technology other than the Internet and relational databases. But I didn't, I had no idea of the new fabrication technologies or what you could do with nanotechnology or biotech or any of this stuff. And I looked at it and I said, there's no reason for poverty. Poverty, there's no reason. I realized. And that was the day I started to laugh about all of this. I never get upset or concerned that we have an economic problem, because I truly understand we have a political problem, but there's no financial or economic problem. There's so much wealth.
There actually is an answer.
Absolutely there's an answer. I mean, we do live in an abundant world. Now, maybe the guys leading the whole thing know that there's an asteroid headed this way that I don't know about. But to my knowledge, I know of no reason why we can't live a civilized existence on this planet.
Without poverty.
Now, we have to bring the population into alignment with the planet. I don't know what that means in terms of what our capacity is. And we have to manage in a civilized fashion. We have to have a much less primitive civilization than we have now. But there's no reason for poverty on planet Earth. And what is extraordinary, when you look at what happens to a simulation, the economy fully optimized, what you realize is the black budget has been draining trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. This whole planetary economy has been harvested and harvested and harvested. And when you realize the extent of the drain, that's when you realize it's remarkable how wealthy we are, let alone what could happen if that drain wasn't disappearing to wherever it's disappearing to. But there's no doubt about it. This is there's a harvest going on, and it's very, very draining. And, but whatever it is, it's not a problem of fundamental economics. It's a political problem. If the drain stops, it may be a problem for the guy who's getting it, any other questions on the...
Just that's a huge insight. And I think it's an insight that it's remarkable that it's escaped people's consciousness that they're not aware of that.
Well, it's so hard to fathom. It took me many decades of tracking and mapping money. It was only when I mapped money by place and by function and looked at it relationally and then started to do these kinds of simulations that I realized. And, of course, for me, the big question was, how could all this be going on and me not know? It was the question I had to ask when I went, I sort of dealt with a litigation with the U.S. government. How could this kind of fraud be going on in the mortgage operation with me as the assistant secretary and me not know? And I had to sit down, John, and work out the nuts and bolts. And it took years of understanding how it could all be going on under my nose and me not see it. And, once you figure that out, now, you and I have talked many times about the fact that I will, to this day, I have very sophisticated people tell me that they can't fathom that the mortgage fraud is anywhere near as bad as I've been saying. Now, this is after, $27 trillion disappeared into the banks through the bailouts and the various Fed interventions. And God knows how much they've shredded with the QE. But my estimate is as the financial coup d'etat literally got away with $40 trillion. And we're talking about fraud at that scale. And yet, despite everything that we've watched and seen, there's still people who can't fathom those numbers.
Well, you're not going to hear about it on the news.
No. Who do you think's financing them? Okay, so let me talk about the next, I think, fundamental economic trend, and that is people need income. We've gone through a period, particularly since 2000, where incomes have been generally falling, unemployment's been rising and people need income. And the way they're going to get that income is by creating a product or service. There are no employers to hire them. In fact, we just saw a recent report, it's up on the blog, that government has been downsizing. So government's laying off because government for a long time sort of picked up the slack. Traditionally, for many decades now, if you look at analyses by the Kauffman Foundation, which is a foundation in Kansas City that focuses on entrepreneurship, if you look at the work of the Kauffman Foundation, the two greatest sources of employment, I think, in this country, employment growth, has been the military and small business. Okay. So, you know, in my experience, the reason many people create small businesses is just to ensure that people have jobs. During the Great Depression, there's a wonderful example of Father Divine, who created thousands of jobs. And in fact, people like Father Divine were doing such a great job of creating sort of entrepreneurial enterprises and jobs. It's one of the reasons they created the WPA. You know, there's a real power shift going on. Anyway, so I've known many restaurants where people started the restaurant not because they wanted to start a restaurant. They're just looking for a way to create jobs for people.
They had nothing else to do, maybe.
Right. And it's funny, and I think it was in Cambridge, one of the most popular restaurants just evolved out of somebody saying, well, you know, we've got all these Armenians. They need to work. What are we going to do? So that's going to be, that trend is going to increase because we are seeing robotics and other forms of automation introduced. There was recently an article, we had it up on the blog, I think about 6 months ago, a firm in Silicon Valley announced they thought they could save the fast food industry $16 or $18 billion a year from automating with robotics. Well, what does that, oh, they had a robot that would cook and package a hamburger.
Wow.
Well, that's what is that? $20 billion of low-income jobs of people just laid off. So there's going to be, we're going through an enormous turnover and transition. A study up on the blog this week says that 50% of the jobs in America are going to be canceled or replaced or influenced by robotics. So what you're talking about is literally the third industrial revolution, where you're going to have enormous transition in the workforce. And of course, globalization continues to happen. I just saw a very interesting article up on the blog about outsourcing construction to the Philippines. So you send your designs and they send the parts back, and you literally put up the building from the fabricated pieces, and you save so much on labor, it makes economic sense to do it. So that means many of us are going to be put in a position where we have to reinvent, recreate ourselves. And the new technology gives us the opportunity to do it. Again, I just see a time coming where it's going to be cheaper to make the toy on your 3D printer than to go down and buy it at Walmart. Okay, so creating income is an important one. Another very important one is lifestyle. Increasingly, the corporate environment is for many people not an environment where they want to work. So you and I do not work in a corporate environment. We like control. We like to control our schedule.
In many cases now, it's not even a matter of choice with downsizing.
Yeah, but even you know, I've rarely seen a person, whether they wanted to leave or didn't leave and end up doing something entrepreneurial, who didn't look healthier and happier.
And happier, yeah.
It's like coming out of a trance. Anyway, so I think a lot of people prefer an entrepreneurial lifestyle. Okay, next reason, and this is something we, Chuck Gibson did a wonderful Solari report on, and that is, you know, we've been able to have an economy that had enormous government subsidy involved in it. So it didn't operate as a market economy. It operated as sort of a friendly Soviet economy, if you will. But we've had enormous government intervention in the credit markets, in the mortgage markets, government subsidy. You know, I live in a county where at least 50% of the households are directly or indirectly dependent on the federal government. Big government subsidy, and that's all been made possible by a bull market in bonds. interest rates have come down for many years. And that has attracted an enormous amount of money into the bond market. And that has been, it is very hard to imagine how interest rates could continue to go lower, or we could continue to command the level of capital globally that we've sucked into the bond market. So we have this giant sucking sound moving into the bond market. Interest rates come down, bond prices go up, and finally it has reached a saturation point where we have the person who runs the largest bond fund in the world declaring that the long-term bull market is dead, if you can imagine that. You know, imagine being the employee trying to run a bond fund. And your boss, Bill Gross, stands up and says that. But if the head of the largest bond fund is declaring the end of bonds, you know the game has reached its, you know, relative conclusion. Now, what does that mean? That means we're not going to be able to prop everything up with cheap government money. We're going to have to go back to financing things with equity. And that's a very, very different model, because when I finance someone with debt, as long as I get my money back, I don't care if they live or die. Debt throws people's incentives out of alignment with each other. So you'll have so many people, when I was a government official or when I was lead financial advisor to FHA, there's so many people would say, well, I'll give you a perfect example. I had Dick Ravitch, who later became the lieutenant governor of New York. I was having dinner with him at the Jockey Club in Washington, and he said, look, as long as I get government subsidies, what do I care if people have education or jobs?
Okay,
right. If I'm financing something with debt, then I don't care about the return to the network. I don't care that society has a total positive return, because I'm making money. You know, it's good for me. It works for me. And so you have all these people sitting on their deck chairs on the Titanic saying, what do I care? I have a government guarantee. Well, you know, if the ship sinks, you got a problem. So you've created with the debt system a system where everybody doesn't care about the whole, you know, so they don't care if the government works as long as they get their check. So you've stopped, you've created an incentive system where nobody cares to make the whole work. And as a society, the fundamental economics are we want to get back to a society where people have an incentive to cooperate and work together. And that's an equity. You know, I'm always telling people, if we had a lot of equity in Iran, we wouldn't be bombing it, you know, or we wouldn't want to bomb it. So equity is a way to create incentives and align between many different kinds of people. Of course, with crowdfunding, the big one is creating alignment between all sorts of different people in your, what I call your human ecology. So your customers become shareholders. Your vendors could become shareholders. All sorts of people that you're doing business with, you can add them to your shareholding in a way that creates a far more dynamic and intelligent thing. Anyway, so the long-term bull market in bonds is coming to an end. And that means we're turning towards equity. And you can feel it, because at some point, rebuilding a financial system with that kind of incentive system is critical, not just to start up businesses or to rebuild the economy, but if we're going to try and align our living systems with financial systems or create anything that's authentic. So all these different things we've been talking about, they hunger for an equity model. Okay, finally, and this is one of my favorite ones, Andrew Vox, one of my favorite, certainly my favorite mystery novel writer, once said the internet is the ultimate op. And I agree with him. I think the internet is the ultimate op, the creator of the one-way mirror, Glenn Greenwald's one-way mirror. But one of the beauties of the internet is it's done extraordinary things for financial literacy. You see all sorts of non-financial people finally making sense of the mumbo jumbo and saying, wait a minute, how could the SEC let Madoff happen? You know, I'll never forget, I was on the board of First American, which was the Clark Clifford Bank in Washington. And when I went on the board, the Harry Albright, who was the trustee, had the Washington law firm bring out I mean, literally tens of thousands of pages of legal documents. The Brinks truck came up to my house in McLean and brought, you know, case after case of documents. And I sat there for 3 days all weekend just reading the whole thing. And when it was over, I realized, oh, you know, this was authorized from the highest levels. The White House, the Department of Justice, Treasury, they all wanted this to happen. They all protected it. This was not. Anyway, so the internet is giving everybody that aha moment, okay? And they're saying, and I keep writing this on the blog, wait a minute, you're telling me that I can, you know, I can pick up the phone and within an hour have cocaine or methamphetamine delivered to my door. I can go down to the grocery store and buy $1 million of lottery tickets, you know, and wipe out my family savings buying lottery tickets. That's no problem. But I can't invest in my neighbor's grocery store because that would be a violation of SEC rules designed to protect me. I don't think so, because they had no problem with Madoff. So what's this about? And so people are beginning to figure out that there's all sorts of rigging going on within the financial system that has nothing to do with what the law says, you know? And so at this point, I think it becomes nearly impossible for the systems to say, no, you can't do this. They've got to find a channel to let the water...
To let some of the pressure off.
To let some of the pressure off. Now, one last item, which I think is very important, is that we've seen since, particularly since 2000, the number of startups and new businesses in this country, the startup creation is dropping dramatically. Dramatically. And what's interesting is if you look at a chart of the rate of new business startups happening here versus China, it's pretty scary. I mean, we are really being left behind.
What do you attribute that to?
I attribute it to a combination of things. One is I attribute it to completely loading the next generation down with student loans. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, we have set it up so that when people come out of college or graduate school, they have to work for a big corporation or go into the army. You know, they're basically in a surf situation. I think that's one. I think we sent, you know, a huge number of young kids to war instead of, you know, putting them in a situation where they could start businesses. I think another thing is we have shut off capital to Main Street, equity capital. And so rather than putting together a community venture fund that funds an apprentice program that will let young entrepreneurs, you know, circle around the different businesses, finance them buying out their parents' business. You know, one of the big issues on Main Street is the having an heir apparent to take over the business. There's a lot of equity values just being lost because there's no heir to take over the business. So no apprentice program, et cetera. I think that's been one of the things. But finally, the rules and regulations and the dirty tricks have become so oppressive. I mean, you look at Solari and how much money and time we just spend on regulatory compliance. You know, coming out of my background, I was a regulator. And so I really care about trying to do a good job at that. If you look at how much time and money we as a small business spend on that, I can't fathom, you know, we have extraordinary background to understand it and deal with it. We have access to all sorts of wonderful lawyers, CPAs, and other experts. I don't see how anybody sits down and figures it out themselves.
So what that means then is up to this point, the powers that be have not really been on the side of people starting small businesses. And that's about to shift.
I think a great deal has been done to discourage small business startup in the last 20 years. And I can't fathom that it's anything other than intentional. So clearly the young talent has been very much tracked so that those kids cycle through things that create equity for the large companies, you know, whether it's they go into the army or they become an employee, or they do a not-for-profit thing that generates value for that group. So I think they very much track people into supporting the large organizations. And with rare exception, Silicon Valley being one of them, they have pretty much discouraged startups, yes.
So why is it about to change?
Well, so let's talk about the top-down agenda. Because I do think if you watch what happened with the passage of the Jobs Act, how it went into effect, who supported it, and what we've seen roll out about it, I think there's tremendous top-down pressure to do this. Now, I also think you have some pretty legitimate people within the enforcement bureaucracy who are really scared about this. And the SEC has really dragged their feet. And I think their reasons for dragging their feet are probably pretty legitimate. You know, they're scared of what can happen when this thing goes in terms of fraud.
I see. Okay.
Okay. Right. So let's go through, because there's enormous, just like there's enormous reason for this fundamental economic hunger to do crowdfunding, we also have a political agenda that wants to orient. You know, I go back to the pools and the piping system. You have this enormous natural wave that wants to, you know, it wants to live and grow and optimize and burst forth. You know, it's full of desire. It's full of lovely kind of ambition. And it's a huge hunger. It's, what is it, Gibran calls it? It's life's longing for itself. You know, it's life. And what we're also watching, I think, is a desire coming from the political leadership to direct that water in a way that serves a variety of their purposes.
Basically to use it.
Yeah, they're looking to surf the wave.
Okay.
But I'm looking for our subscribers to see the dynamics and also surf the wave. So I just want you to know you're not going to be, there's a big guy with a big surfboard. Mr. Global is bringing his surfboard down to the beach. So I want you to watch out, not get run over by a surfboard. Okay, the first thing is, we are watching one of the most unprecedented, if not the most unprecedented, unsuppression of technology, and technology being allowed out of the lab, or is coming out of the lab. So we're watching a fundamental shift in access to knowledge and technology, which is explosive, beautiful, terrifying. We've had several Celeria reports. One is called View from Silicon Valley that Chuck and I did on some of the technology that you're really seeing shift the equity markets, and that's part of the reason for the sort of big, strong growth in the North American markets. You're also, second week in October, we're doing a Celeria report on 3D printing, and that's going to be the first of several Celeria reports we do on the sort of different technology, but it's quite extraordinary. It's happening in the area of fabrication technology. It's happening in composite materials. It's happening in robotics. It's happening in biotech. And in all these areas, they include integrating digital technology into the basic infrastructure. So one of my nicknames for it is the digital heartland. The digital heartland, imagine, you know, driverless cars on digitized highways, and the cars talk to the highways, and they're all in the cloud. And so you don't need to know how to get to the place. You just need to tell the car where you want to go, and then you can be busy, you know, playing with your kids or doing whatever, and you don't lose that time anymore. The car just takes you there because you have digital highways and digital driverless cars, okay? That's the digitization of the heartland. That's integration of the technology into the infrastructure.
And that's just one example among very many.
Thousands and thousands. Now, here's the reality. The reality is when you roll out new technology. So let me give you an example. One of the big gold rushes in the patent world is patents on graphene. Graphene is a form of composite material using, it's a form of composite material that is expected to be significantly lighter than steel, but much stronger, so that you can make a much lighter car, which is much more safe than what you've got now. So it uses much less fossil fuel. Yeah. Right. So anyway, so when you have this explosion of technology that can reinvent the manufacturing base and put the manufacturing base in America back into competition with Asia and the global emerging markets, we can get back in the game in terms of manufacturing. We can digitize the heartland, make the infrastructure much more efficient. When you have this kind of technology and you want to go fast, it is much better to have thousands of new companies try stuff, because you have a much more organic, creative, dynamic use, and you bring much more imagination and inventiveness to the process, and you have a much higher intelligence.
Plus there's competition.
Yeah, it's a very positive competition. So if you're the leadership and you just want to try stuff and see what happens, bingo, bingo. You want millions of startups. Now, here's why the NSA scandal has been so important. What the NSA scandal reminds us is, if you put $1 million to finance a startup that's going to prototype your new fabrication technology and its application in a certain area of manufacturing, you don't have to wait for them to file patents, because you can just listen to everything they're doing and steal it. Okay? So we're talking about a leadership that's going to finance a whole bunch of efforts, but will be in a position behind the one-way mirror to steal everything.
That's actually been one of the big points about the NSA scandal that I think a lot of other people have missed, is that it gives certain powers an opportunity to know things about business dealings. It's not just about everyday privacy and phone conversations. It's inside information.
Right. So imagine they're not listening. The company files a patent. The patent's worth $10 million. They come in to buy the company. By listening to the company discussing this with their investment banker and their lawyer, they can figure out how to save money on the negotiations. In fact, they can, you know, if you watch the movie Antitrust, or the movie Startup, which are two of the startup movies we've recommended on the Solaria Report, you'll see examples of where a company was specifically attacked in a way that dramatically reduced its price so they could pick it up cheap. Okay. Sort of see all the games. And so it's very important, if you are an entrepreneur starting up a company doing these kinds of things, that you think a lot about security in a world where security is a very different game. Another movie that's excellent in addition to Antitrust and Startup is one we've recommended in the Solaria Report called The Listening. And it's all about invasive technology getting in and stealing your secrets. So I think one of the top-down's agenda is, this is a much more economic way for the leadership to, and the large companies, to prototype the new technology that they need. That's number one. Number two, I think that doing it this way makes sure that that technology is socially acceptable to the young people, because the young people are leading its invention and development. And that's very important to get it adopted more widely. So, you know, if you come to me and say, oh, isn't it wonderful? You can have a driverless car and go down the highway and the driverless car will take you. And I said, great. I remember when I was litigating with the Department of Justice and I was driving outside the FBI headquarters and a team tried to run me off the road. Now, imagine if they could have hacked into the computer and just taken over my car. Well, I don't think that's such a good idea. No, thank you. You know, so they think the older people are going to be difficult about adapting new technology, whereas the younger people are going to say, oh, way cool. You know, then I don't have to drive. I can talk to my kids. Isn't that wonderful? You know, so you want to make sure that the kids help you lead the adaptation of this kind of new technology. The third thing is that, you know, and I hate to mention dark things, but I need to mention some dark things. You want to make sure you've just moved And I go back to the commentary I just put up on the blog about the governance shell game. So we had an economy with $100 trillion of liabilities and $100 trillion of assets. We stole $40 trillion of assets and moved it into this new breakaway civilization. Now the old economy has $100 trillion of liabilities and only $60 trillion of assets. And they're sitting there saying, okay, they're starting to fight over who's going to get the assets for their liabilities. You know, who's going to get 100 cents on the dollar, who's going to get 50 cents on the dollar, and who's just going to get rolled. Okay, so that's a conversation that's going on, and it's scarier and scarier. And then you've got this new money sitting over here. Well, how do you deal with that politically? You take a portion of the money you've stolen, and you go into the legacy economy, and you turn to the top 1 to 10% of the young kids, and you say, oh, I'll finance your business. Now, let's look at that at a household level. You just stole $250,000 from their parents, which means they were going to inherit that money. Now they're not going to inherit it because you just stole it. And you're coming back in and using it to buy their attention and loyalty.
When you say you stole $250,000, give an example. Debasement of the currency, other ways?
I pumped and dumped the telecoms and the internet stocks. That lost $40,000 on their portfolio. Then I ran the debasement on the U.S. currency. That lost them another $40,000 of equivalent purchasing power, if not more. Then I did the 2008 slam down, and I pumped and dumped, you know, the housing market, and that caused 3 foreclosures next to their home, which lowered their housing price. And when you add them all up, they're out, you know, and meantime, I used their bank deposits to finance a company moving jobs abroad in a way that, you know, cost the guy his job, and so he had to get a job at a lower income, you know. And when you add them all up, he's out $250,000. You know, not to mention he had money in an ETF that was serviced by AIG, and it got wiped out when AIG went down, you know, where you had Fannie Mae stock. So this guy's, you know, this family's lost $250,000. Meantime, that $250,000 is in your pocket, and you're using it to finance his kid starting a company where you have a big sizable equity position, and his kid comes home every night for every week for dinner telling you that the American dream really works. And you gotta suck it up. Okay? And, you know, I'm a great believer that there are no secrets, you know, at the end of the day at a spiritual level. So everybody knows something's terribly wrong, but they can't quite put their... It's the ultimate beatdown. You know, what you'll see in the black neighborhoods when I was a kid is, you know, that you bring the drugs in, then you announce on TV that the reason this is all happening because the people who live there are scum. You know, so you blame the victim. And then, you know, the brightest and best kid gets a scholarship to an Ivy League university, and the guys who are running the drugs come in and do a photo op where the kid and the parents have to thank him and kiss his ring. Do you know what I mean? It's the beatdown.
Gotcha.
You have to thank the guy who destroyed you for his help in saving you from this terrible thing, which was really your fault. Anyway, it's as a political matter, it has always worked as a tactic.
Yeah.
Okay, it's been very, very successful. And it's been very, very successful for these guys. I'll never forget it. When they seized Hamilton in 1998, right after we were still dealing with the FBI teams being in the building and sort of managing that process, and it was right at the point when they tried to falsify evidence against us, and we caught them and turned in an affidavit and were able to prove that they were engaged in a criminal conspiracy to falsify evidence because they couldn't find any wrongdoing. We were too clean. So at the time, George Soros was a member of the Executive Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations. And literally every other day I was getting a call from somebody who's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations with a little sort of message, you know, do this, do that. And I learned a lot about the Council on Foreign Relations during the period just from all the phone calls. But right after this, I get approached by one such member who says, we would like you to apply to Soros's foundation for a grant to do your work. I thought, wait a minute. I had a private business that was wildly successful, that was worth a lot of equity, and as I was successful, it was building equity value for me and my shareholders. And now you want me to start a not-for-profit to do what I was doing so that it creates no equity for me and for my shareholders who, and meantime, you guys just stole all my software, you stole all my people, you stole everything. And now you want me to beg for a little piece of it from a guy who's sitting on the executive committee and council on foreign relations, which I know is related to this. And then I realized, oh, they're cycling back a small amount of the money they made. You know, basically, if you look at what they were doing to destroy Hamilton, that was making them a whole bunch of money. And they were taking a tiny bit of their profits and they were cycling it back to kind of find a vehicle to manage me. And I said, you know, I don't do that. I don't become financially dependent on the people who steal my money. I don't get bought with my own money.
Unfortunately, anyway, it's happening now on a much larger scale.
It's happening on a huge scale. And it's always, that's why I used to always worry about the Occupy kids when they were saying the 1%. Because what they didn't realize it, but what they were being encouraged to promote was something that would be used to literally reduce the net worth of their parents. They were promoting policies that was going to cause them to lose their inheritance. It was pretty scary. That's why, you know, I tell everybody there is nothing more important than to understand what the world looks like from the vantage point of understanding family wealth. Family wealth is what creates healthy communities. Until, you know, we have to be in the business of building family wealth. And that's one of the great opportunities on crowdfunding. It's a great opportunity to build family wealth. Okay, so what's the next top-down agenda? We've had a housing bubble. We pumped and dumped the housing market. It's fair to say that a tremendous amount of real estate has consolidated in for private ownership. We've seen big hedge funds and institutions running around and buying up enormous amounts of residential housing, single-family homes, multifamily homes. So we have an enormous consolidation of ownership of real estate at cheap. Now, once you buy it all up, what do you want to have happen?
You want the value to go up.
You want the value to go up. Now, if suddenly you allow lots of small business financing and lots of small business growth, what's going to happen?
Exactly that.
We just saw today a New York developer is announcing he's going to use the Jobs Act to raise $31 million to do a development in New York.
So it's beginning to look like the beginning of a new boom.
Twitter just filed their first filing under the Jobs Act of 2012.
There you go.
Okay, so remember, up to $1 billion of revenue, that's not a tiny Main Street company. So this, you know, crowdfunding can be used to do a lot to not only create a strong economy that needs the real estate and is going to raise real estate, but to finance real estate. Okay. And it's going to be interesting to watch because you're going to literally see a situation where, you know, the banks wouldn't do a workout with a homeowner at $200,000, but they're flipping the property into an institutional investor at $150,000, or it's going through a HUD foreclosure that ends up on an inside deal at $125,000, and then those institutions are going to come back and finance into you saying, oh, this is something you should buy in your IRA. It's going to help America. Okay, so it's all, another one of the examples of the beatdown. Okay, so we want the value of the real estate going up. Another thing is laundering money. Now, under the Jobs Act, there's been all sorts of efforts set up to authenticate investors. We don't know what the final regulations are going to be, but it's supposedly all designed to prevent money laundering. I think there's, once this thing gets going,
it's going to be money laundering central.
I think there's going to be tremendous money laundering into this because the ability to create straw men and falsify papers is going to be very easy.
Well, particularly if you're law enforcement.
Right. Now let's go back. You're the leadership. You want all of this technology prototyped. You have the ability through the information systems to steal a lot of the ideas and money anyway through the back door. But you also have the ability to turn it into a financial fraud. So let's say I have $100 million. I finance 100 companies, $1 million each. I do most of it through straw men, through the internet. Those 100 companies, let's say you're going to have a very high failure rate. 10 of them turn out to be legitimate. Those 10 are probably worth $10 million each. So they're worth $100 million. But I cook them up, I pump them up, and I dump them into the pension funds and take them retail for a way above market, $100 million each. I get my $1 billion out. I've made an enormous, I've made $900 million. And then they crater the way the tech bubble. That's exactly what I believe happened with the tech bubble. So you fatten. I was sitting in 1996 at Esther Dyson's conference in Arizona, and all the venture capitalists were throwing money at these companies that wanted financing. You know, and the companies wanted $500,000, and the venture capitalists said, you have to take $10 million. They said, we don't need $10 million. They said, you have to take $10 million. And they would give them $10 million. And it was scary because we didn't realize that. I couldn't figure out what in the world was going on, because these were companies, John, that could never, that had no product or service could ever sell. They could never sell a product or service to a real customer. And I thought, it doesn't make any sense. Why are they doing this? And I didn't realize that it was just going to be a financial fraud. They were looking to create a trading sardine. If you know the old Wall Street story about the sardines.
The last guy.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, they primed these things up. They knocked them up to these huge values. They stuffed them in the pension funds in the retail market, and then it crashed. But they made a fortune riding the wave. So that's the question. Do they want to prototype all the technology and get the technology adapted, but they want to do it in a way where they can many times multiply their money.
Well, I'm sure there are listeners here that were burned with some tech investments in the last bubble.
Right.
Hearing this, you're going to start to say, okay, I'm not going to get burned twice. Can you talk a little bit about what to watch out for?
Right. And when we get to the section on investors, we'll definitely go through all of that. I think what's important is, again, you've got a huge wave of money. And when a huge wave of money goes by, it means you can get things done. There's going to be capital to get things done with. And there are going to be legitimate companies started that do great things. And you want to make sure, as this great wave goes by, that you channel it into something that's lasting. Okay? Lots of other people may be doing things that aren't lasting. Don't get caught up in that. You know, you ride the wave to create something lasting that has truly, you know, a positive return to both the investors and the network.
Or another way of putting it, there has to be real value there.
Right, right. You have to say, I'm not here to play bubble. Yeah. I'm here to do something really powerful and useful and important. And I'm going to use this capital, or I'm going to use my capital to support those kinds of things, because this window opening, A lot of stuff's going to go through this window, and some of it's going to be good, and some of it's going to be bad. One of my favorite scriptures is says something to the effect of what the enemy intended for my ill, God meant it for my good. It's judo. Think of it as corporate judo. So this window is going to be open for a variety of reasons. We can drive our agenda through the window too. Okay. But you've got to stick with fundamentals. So don't get caught up in the bubble. Look at real value. Okay, but I think there is going to be this tech bubble fraud aspect. A final thing is I keep coming back on the Saleri report to a very important issue, and that is that by engineering this explosion in domestic gas and oil reserves and bringing the price of gas down, we have now significantly reduce the cost, the major component, the largest cost within a manufacturing operation. Jim Norman, when he interviewed on the Saleri report doing the oil card, said that energy is 40% of the cost of manufacturing. Now, he means not just the direct cost, but when you translate back into the different parts and everything, total cost. So that's a very big component. And by so lowering the price of energy here in this country and improving domestic reserves, it puts manufacturing back in a position to start to be very competitive globally. Now, you add this kind of technology, and now you're really talking about making us competitive worldwide in manufacturing, in a revival of manufacturing, not in a way that creates new jobs, because this is going to be very high-tech stuff.
With robotics.
Yeah, but something that enables us to do far more manufacturing either here within a company or, as I said, you know, kids can make their own toys on the 3D printer, manufacturing with a home. I think it's one of the reasons you're seeing the real development of what's called open source hardware. We had March and Jakubowski on the Solari Report several months ago. He's a leader in the open source hardware, and I think that's why open source hardware is becoming fashionable now, because it's time to digitize the heartland and the infrastructure and manufacturing. So hard, you know, tractors are, you know, get ready for tractors to get very, very fashionable. So now it makes our infrastructure and our manufacturing much more competitive. But I think one of the reasons that's desired is there is more and more manufacturing that we are doing for national security or for very sensitive projects that we don't want to do in China. We don't want to do abroad. The political sensitivities are getting too tricky. And so I think they have, the leadership has an unbelievably ambitious manufacturing agenda, among other things, because of the gearing up to do tremendous amounts in space. If you look through all the popular magazines like Popular Science, Popular Mechanics, Wired Magazine, anything focused on technology and innovation, MIT Technology Review, you just have enormous numbers of articles on space.
All at once.
All at once. Well, and you have enormous numbers of very successful entrepreneurs saying, you know, let's go do mining in space. Let's build space elevators. Let's, you know, you have 200,000 people signing up for a one-way trip to Mars. I mean, this is...
The timing's very interesting.
Right. And if you're going to build out the kind of infrastructure you need to build lots of spaceships or lots of space elevators or a platform that, you know, that sits in space and captures solar energy, a power plant in space, the Japanese are working on that. All of these different things require enormous manufacturing productivity to do and do economically. And I think part of it is you can, by encouraging lots of small companies and entrepreneurs to take on these kinds of technologies and see what they can do with them, you know, graphene makes it possible to economically build an elevator to the moon. So I think if you want to build that kind of stuff, you want to build it in North America, or you want to build, the Anglo-American Alliance is going to want to build it in the Anglo-American countries. It's going to be Canada, UK, Australia, US. And so I think they're bringing a lot of that back into the heartland because they're not comfortable depending on, you know, someone in Asia to do it. It's going to be a much more politically sensitive thing. And I think they want to accelerate that program and go fast. And crowdfunding is a way to seed a lot of activities. And it's also a way to make those activities seem fashionable. If you want to attract lots of the younger generations into coming back into engineering school and getting interested in aerospace and hardware, this is how you're going to do it.
Well, part of that fashionable aspect too is going to be success and money. You're going to be hearing stories about people getting rich.
Right, right. Okay. I also think they want to engineer a crash up in the stock market. There's several ways we can go. We've issued trillions of dollars of bonds, and we've sucked the money out of the legacy systems. One way is we can just grind through that and have, you know, a very ugly slow burn down in the legacy systems as this new economy sort of grows and develops, high-tech economy. However, if we get what's called a crash up, all the money that we've been printing starts to move out of bonds and it moves into the stock market, it will raise the value of equity, which will help to carry the debt that's been outstanding. Think of it this way. If you have a house and you've borrowed and borrowed and borrowed and borrowed and borrowed and borrowed on the value of your house and your house is underwater, well, you can write down the debt and have a bankruptcy, or you can have a boom in the housing market and the price of the house goes back up, 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 up. And generally the equity valuations pass the, you know, you start to be able to carry the debt. Now, you know, that's grossly oversimplified, but I would say that every effort is going to be made to engineer a crash up in the equity markets. Part of that is going to be trying to encourage investors globally to convert from a world of being an investor in bonds and fixed income to being one in equity. Generally, the U.S. as a population is used to owning stocks in much greater amounts than people in Asia or Europe, let alone Latin America and Africa. So I think part of this is making equity fashionable globally, and nothing does that better than the kids. One of the things anybody who's ever worked in housing in this country knows is you can't have a housing bubble with at first getting the first-time home buyers all getting financing, buying homes, and that kicks everybody to sell their home to the first-time home buyer, and then they go buy a bigger home, and everybody sort of cascades upward in the bubble. Same thing with equity. I think you've had a real fall in startups. You've got to dramatically increase the startups and capital to small business. They'll breed up. They'll start to go public. You'll start to create more new companies in the stock. It's frightening. The number of companies in the stock market has really dramatically declined. And so you've got to refresh that. So I think having a crash up in the equity markets, particularly globally, requires that startup rate to kick up. And if you look at reports from around the globe, one of the things that first clued me into the fact that this is going to be really, really big is seeing all the different countries that are doing this or planning on doing this or passing laws to do this. You know, crowdfunding is something that's going to happen globally. And it's going to roll out at the same time.
Well, so that would indicate that there's some powerful forces behind it.
Yes. Yes. Now, here's what's interesting, and I come back to the NSA scandal. You have now created a platform through all the big digital and telecommunications companies like Google, Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, the social media. You've now created a platform, a digital platform that is global. It is worldwide. You have people all over Africa on Facebook and Google. Now you're going to start to move the financial flows onto those platforms. Crowdfunding, Bitcoin, whether it's currency or equity, you're going to be moving out of the exchanges and onto this new platform. Now what that means is the money in society is going to go from one channel and it's going to start to move into another channel. That is an enormous power shift in who controls access to intelligence in the economy and who is channeling the economic flows.
Well, you just talked about the new channel that it's going to move to. Talk a little bit about the old channel.
Well, the old channel, you have things going through the banks, through the New York Stock Exchange, the exchanges, and the traditional clearing systems. Now you're talking about them going through the internet, through Google, through Facebook, and literally through a different set of cables, you know, different payment systems. And what that does is both in terms of intelligence and then financial flows, it's a whole different set of players who are seeing the information and getting the fee flow.
So there's got to be some nervousness on the part of the old team.
Well, I think the old team was very much had a great deal to do with the Edward Snowden and revelations. One of the commentaries I wrote on the blog was, who's protecting Glenn Greenwald? Why does Glenn Greenwald get to run around and be safe doing this when, you know, numerous reporters have been assassinated for far less? And, you know, this is clearly an effort that has tremendous support from some very powerful people. And I think what you're watching is before we start to switch the financial flows in a significant way onto this new platform, everybody who's not in command on the new platform is saying, wait a minute. And they're warning the leadership of the G20, you know, your financial system is about to be controlled through Facebook and Google. Do you really want that? And do you really want the people who control that listening to all your phone calls? P.S., they're spying on you. You have no privacy, which means you have no intellectual capital. They can suck up 100% of your intellectual capital every day, all day long.
Potentially, there's a lot more control.
Much. Huge. Because this is a harvesting machinery. This is an economic warfare harvesting machinery. Okay? And so I think the NSA revelations and sort of scandal is these factions competing and fighting about who's going to control that turf. Because if it just proceeds, if it had just proceeded to roll out without that, you know, you're talking about a very small handful of players controlling all the intelligence on all the financial transactions on the planet and having an inside, you know, inside window onto enormous economic intelligence in an unprecedented way. Yeah. It's pretty scary.
On an individual level.
Yeah.
People.
Yeah. So you're able to, as I said, you're able to learn everything they're doing and you can file the patent before they do. You know, the theft of intellectual capital that rolls out through that whole, you know, it's the greatest intellectual piracy machinery ever created. It's quite extraordinary. So, and of course, you know, the question is who? I think one of the powerful players behind Snowden, and who's taking a huge whack, is the Vatican. Because as we saw, that network took a huge whack at them. So they're whacking back, is what I believe. Now, it's funny. The, you know, say 10 or 20 years ago, the Anglo-American Alliance, basically City of London and New York, controlled about 70% of the capital flows flowing through the financial markets. That's dropped down after 2008. I think that's dropped down to about 50% or less. This network was clearly positioned to get them back up to 70% is what I believe. Or, you know, absolutely shore up their position as master of the global financial flows. It's quite, you know, one way to look at it is it's the American grab. You know, so I think the Jobs Act was going to contribute to get America back to its 70%. You know, Google and Facebook's role in this is pretty potentially frightening. You know, and we have a great interview with Catherine Albrecht about how to protect yourself from Google that I, another interesting question about this is what is the role of the defense contractors? Because, you know, NSA is really not so much a government agency, but a contracting operation for allocating contracts to Lockheed Martin and group of the defense contractors. It's very interesting as the NSA revelations get worse and worse and worse. Lockheed's stock is just levitating into the stratosphere. So, and usually in situations like this, you'll see the political appointees lose power and the contractors increase their power. So that's not surprising. Okay, so those are the reasons that we see a political agenda. And I think there's an enormous political agenda here. It's multivariate. Whenever you get these big capital flows, it's always multivariate. And of course, the top guys never say, you know, I want to go to Rome. How can I get to Rome? What they say is, how can I make money getting to Rome? How can I make money getting everybody who want to take me to Rome? So it's very much about engineering the incentive systems and the sort of conditions. And that's easy to do because we have enormous pent-up demand. I remember reading a survey almost 20 years ago of the number of people who wanted to invest their 401k or their IRA into a vehicle that expressed their community. And it's extraordinary, the pent-up demand for this. So I think there, and one of the things crowdfunding will do is it will allow us to really, you know, organize investment into a particular network or into a particular place. So community will absolutely be an aspect to it. So they're seeing this pent-up demand. They're going to let it loose, but they're going to use it in a very, you know, if you look at what I think their goals are, I think what they're up to is very, very clever. It's there's no doubt about it. They are definitely optimizing the flow from their point of view.
Well, if you look at what happened with the internet bubble, the tech bubble, it was very, very sexy. And when you look at the amount of money that was made, at least initially, it was difficult for anyone to kind of see it for what it was.
Right. And what was amazing was Silicon Valley before the tech bubble was such an alive and wonderful place. And you had hundreds of entrepreneurs, all who were thrilled about how they were going to save the world. They were going to make a world a better place. It was going to be wonderful. They were going to take this technology and really help people and make people's lives better. And you literally, I'll never forget coming back to Silicon Valley many years after it was all over, and everybody and everything was working for defense contractors. You know, the boys had pumped and dumped this place, rolled it, and they were now in control. They had exerted authority, and everyone was now obedient. And the beauty of it was, yeah, they invested a whole bunch of money, but if you look at where they got out at the top, they made a fortune on the fraud and used the fraud to subjugate an entire world of people. And to this day, I've never met anybody in Silicon Valley who understands what's happened. You know, you had been ad, baby. Anyway, so it's, as I said, it's going to be quite a wave. And the interesting thing is there are, you know, if an effort is made to engineer a crash up in the stock market, I have to say, I agree with that. In other words, we cannot build a society where people are incentivized to collaborate without shifting to an equity model. And I've said for many years that the reason I thought when the financial coup d'etat was finished that the people leading it would want to move to sound currency and equity model is because once you've stolen everything, then you want to go back to sound currency so that you can keep what you stole. And you want an equity model because you want everybody to cooperate and you're willing to invest back in them a piece of what you stole from them. And it's simply a way to convert it to an equity model.
It's mind-boggling.
Well, I call it the planetary debt for equity swap, and I'm in full support. And I have to tell you, I can just see them. I can hear their voices now. They're kind of laughing at me. Because what they're going to say is, look, you know, the only way that you can get the general population to shift into an equity model, you know, is to pull the rug out from under and then offer them a treat to come in. And that's the only way it's going to work. And so we're re-engineering things to, you know, this is the way it works. And this is how, you know, this is how you get the herd to go through the gate. And you're just being naive, Catherine, as you always have been. You know, I can just hear their voices now. Anyway, so John, fundamental economics, political agenda, meet together in this explosive, dynamic thing, which is going to happen. And of course, anything can happen. We don't know. This is what I see. Let's see how it unfolds. Anything could happen. And so let's finish this part of the interview and we'll turn and talk about entrepreneurs and investors and what it means to you. Before I close, anything else on macro?
I just want to say it's quite a picture that you're painting. It's quite a view.
Okay, so you're a private investor. How does it strike you sitting here with your portfolio? What are you thinking?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, don't fall for the hype. Be careful. Because, you know, I remember the internet stocks, and there was an awful lot of hype there, and a lot of people bought it. But secondly, it does seem that there will be some profit opportunities probably in the infrastructure companies, the companies that build this out.
Right.
So I think
there's going to be extraordinary opportunities. You know, that if you're an investor and this wave of technology comes out, it's going to come out in all sectors. It's going to come out in the publicly traded companies. It's going to come out in startups. It's going to come out in small businesses that then go public. So you're going to see it run the gamut of the private equity, the traditional private equity, all the way up to the publicly traded stocks. And it's funny, you can say, well, I'm not interested in new technology. The reality is some of those new technology companies are going to pull the rug out from under the companies you own. So you can't, it's not like you can put your head in the sand and say, I don't want to think about it.
It's,
you know,
one way or the other, it's going to happen.
It's coming. The wave is coming. It's one of my favorite preachers is T.D. Jakes. He says, get ready, get ready, get ready. So get ready. Now, in the crowdfunding area, I think, though, my number one fear about the Salary Report subscribers is I think they're going to get inundated.
With requests.
With requests, with marketing. You know, we don't know what the SEC regulations are going to look like. But one of the things we know is there's a real effort to get deals to go through something called portals. Mm-hmm. And so a portal will vet deals, and a portal will not let deals come through the portal unless they've been due diligence and they're up to snuff. And
which, from the investor perspective, is a very good thing.
I think it's a very good thing. It's a, you know, it's a group of people who are expert, who will help raise your standards, who will help you understand the process. You'll pay them a fee, but it will save you money in the long run. And so a portal is a very good thing. But once this thing gets going, who knows how crazy it could get, how many portals could get. So my concern is that anyone who's got a little bit of capital is just going to get inundated by proposals.
Yeah.
And, of course, many of these proposals are going to be very heartfelt. They're going to be from your friend's kids or your kids or your kids' friends or, you know, everybody's going to have a way to sort of touch you. And it's very important to understand when it comes to small business investment, you know, my rule is be prepared to lose 100%. Okay? This is a philanthropic donation, which you hope works out, and you'd rather make it, just like the poll that I read from Yahoo Finance, you'd rather make it as an investment because it encourages them to think in terms of ways of creating an ongoing enterprise, a healthy enterprise. But it's unbelievably high risk, no matter how wonderful it sounds.
Well, you know, a couple of ways to sort of mitigate risk would be to invest with people that you know or in places that you know.
Right. And I think one of the great opportunities in crowdfunding, one of my, some of my favorite sites are ones that encourage you not just to make a donation, but in essence to buy a pre-order. So we see Slow Money starting a website, Credibles, or promoting a website called Credibles, where you finance a company not with equity, but with pre-orders. So you put in $1,000 and get $1,000 credit from that food company. And I think one thing we're all struggling with is how do we find a way of getting fresh food, which is healthy and grown locally? And the reality, John, is if we're going to have farms and grocery stores and food processors who provide us with a fresh, local, safe food supply, we're going to have to finance them. We're going to have to bank it. Do you know what it's? And so to me, crowdfunding is a wonderful vehicle for us to finance things which we need and want. And so you're not financing it to get a financial return. You're financing it so that you have strategic access to a very important thing.
You're helping to build your world.
You're helping to build your world. You're helping to build the world you need to survive.
Yeah.
And you can't survive unless you've got farmers and grocers and cooks and food processors who can provide you with food that you can trust.
So it's a tool.
It's a tool to build your world. And so I'm a lot... You know, we just did a term sheet that I'll put up on the blog for this Salary Report where we designed a legal structure for a company that was starting a food shop. And we had debt and equity. So the shares were non-voting shares. And I think the voting terms and conditions on shares is a very important issue when it comes to raising capital in these kinds of ways. But so it was equity, so it was non-voting shares, and then loans that were convertible at the option of the company into store credits. Okay. So you sell $5,000 of loans to someone, they buy $5,000 of loans, but when the shop's open, you have the right, instead of struggling to pay that debt, to convert it into $5,000 of store credits. And that's a customer flow. Okay. John and I are back for another discussion of crowdfunding on the Solari Report. John, welcome.
Hi, Catherine.
It's good to have you. We're going to be talking about entrepreneurs. What does crowdfunding mean for entrepreneurs, for investors, and for all of us? We've been at the big picture level discussing the general economic trends and also the political agenda. And that's important because whether you're an entrepreneur or investor or someone simply watching this phenomena, it's extremely important to me that you be able to see the general dynamic and flows, the general economics and politics, because this is going to be, I liken it to a wave, a financial wave, and I want to make sure you surf it as opposed to get, you know, sort of caught by the wave and drowned in the wave. So very important you see the game, and I encourage you to listen to that. Let's start with entrepreneurs. And first, let me describe some of the resources we've created for you to help you approach this topic. At the blog for this Solari Report, you'll find a wealth of links and recommended readings, which we think will help. One of the ones we've prepared for you is I asked attorney Carolyn Betts, who's very knowledgeable about U.S. securities laws as they apply to all kinds of business, but including startup and small business. I've asked Carolyn to prepare an article called Legal Pathways for Entrepreneurs to Raise Capital Using Securities. Does Crowdfunding Ease the Way? Currently, all issuance of securities theoretically is subject to registration with the SEC. And within that process, there are exempted pathways. So ways of raising capital where it is not necessary to do a full-blown registration statement with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And I asked Carolyn to prepare an article that outlines and provides links to help you understand what those five pathways are. Crowdfunding is going to create, in theory, a sixth pathway. We need to see what the regulations say when they're promulgated. And what's important to you as an entrepreneur is that you, if you're going to issue securities, that you find the pathway which is best for you. And so before you automatically assume that crowdfunding is going to be the best pathway, I encourage you to take a look at that article and make sure you understand the different pathways. As you'll see when you read it, you will discover that, you know, this is a complex topic. So I encourage you, if anything, I'm hoping that that article makes it easier for your attorney. And certainly one of the pathways is the state pathway. And it's extremely important that you see an attorney who is knowledgeable about and registered and licensed to practice in the state in which you have a jurisdiction. So with that, let me describe some of the other, we've put up links to some of the other Solari reports that I think will be very helpful to an entrepreneur in this situation. One is we did an interview with Peter Ireland, who's got a wonderful guide called The Startup Guide. And it really helps entrepreneurs understand how to start and build a company with the minimal amount of capital. You know, I'm always saying to people, you need to start a, what you need to start a company is profit, not capital. And Peter's very inventive at helping entrepreneurs figure out how they can do things. One of the popular techniques with crowdfunding, which I think is terrific, of course, is selling pre-orders. So we've now seen lots of authors on Amazon selling pre-orders and raising money through pre-orders. If you look at the donation crowdfunding, you see many gifts given, and they're essentially giving you one of something that they're making or giving you several of something that they're making. We just finished doing a term sheet for an entrepreneur who's starting a food shop, and we structured it with they're selling both loans and equity. We structured the equity as non-voting shares. Very important to bring in capital in a way that you can't lose control of the company as a result of sort of disagreements with your shareholders. And so one was selling non-voting shares, but the other was selling loans that were convertible into food credits. And we've put that term sheet up on the as part of the resources to this Solaria report. And I think that will be that's a really good example of combining this idea of raising capital with essentially selling pre-orders. We also have an audio seminar, which I did many years ago with Franklin Sanders, called Building Real Wealth, which I think is a wonderful discussion of the issues of how you really create a business and grow a business. And I think it's very useful to anybody contemplating starting their own business or running their own business. We have another Solaria report called Family Wealth with Jay Hughes, and it's a discussion of how families can get together and build wealth. And a lot of the crowdfunding process, I think, is going to draw on family resources. So I encourage you to do that. And last but not least, we have a Solaria report called it's how to set up a legal and capital structure for your company. And it walks you through the issues of whether you're going by crowdfunding or any of the other five pathways. What are the issues that come up in designing the legal and capital structure for your company? And how do you think through what that looks like? So I think all of those would be very helpful. Any comments?
No.
Okay. The first thing that I want to stress to any entrepreneur who's contemplating doing a crowdfunding is that this is not only a legal pathway to raise capital, but it's a different way of building the human ecology for your company. So we're talking about, and I want to focus on the word crowd. We're talking about creating a field where your customers, your vendors, the other people involved in your network or in your life become, in addition to the roles they may play, they also become an owner. They also become a shareholder. And there's tremendous power in this where it works, because you're talking about creating an alignment between, for example, your customers and your capital structure. So let me give you an example. If I go down to a big box store and I spend $10,000 a year on goods and products and services, and they make a profit of, say, $2,000, and their stock is traded at a multiple of 10 times earnings, that means their stock goes up $20,000 a year. Now, how much of that do I get? None. But if I'm in either a pool of small businesses or an investor in a small business, the more money I spend at that store, the more the value of my stock goes up. So in essence, I get, it's what we call skin in the game. I get a piece of the action. And so I have rejiggered my alignment between me and my customer, because now my customer isn't just trying to get the best deal on this purchase. They want me to make money. They want me to succeed. And now we have created the conditions for a very powerful communications incentive between them and me. You know, so imagine a world where all your customers, because they're shareholders, are running around the world seeing opportunities and bringing them to you, you know. At times, this can feel very critical to have that much feedback, but they have a vested interest in making sure your business is growing and thriving and working. And so what you're talking about doing is creating, a crowd intelligence, which is deeply vested in your success. You know, now that can be good when they're calling you at Saturday night and saying, hey, did you know your competitor's doing this? You know, that can also be overwhelming, but it's a much more intense way of going about it. And it's a much richer way. And I think it can be incredibly useful because the mistake, one of the greatest mistakes entrepreneurs make is they, and I shouldn't say they, I should say we have an idea and we don't see the things we don't see. We don't know what we don't know. And we need massive market feedback to really teach us that. And the faster we get that feedback, the less capital we spend not getting that feedback, if you know what I mean. So I think there's a tremendous value to this kind of sort of intense community way of doing things. I also believe that there are going to be tremendous, if you look at the fundamental economics of what's driving this, there are going to be tremendous advantages of aggregating in various ways, both by place and by community. So within a community, you're going to have ways of kind of aggregating and going through what are called portals. A portal is a website which is specifically created to help entrepreneurs crowdfund, and it's registered with appropriate regulators and is really expert in dealing with all the different legal issues. And so a portal may focus on a community, or it may focus on a network, or it may focus on a particular kind of size of opportunity. We already have, I think, about 400 to 500 portals existing. Once the regulations pass, my guess is it's gonna increase dramatically. So you're going to have portals that specify in various kinds of aggregations or groupings. And that's going to be the basis for lots of support and help and expertise for different kinds of entrepreneurs. So until the regulations are available, we don't have a lot of knowledge. This could go in many different ways. But I think if I could say one last thing, I was talking to an entrepreneur last week who was a little bit blasé about the legal and financial particulars. And I said to them, look, if you were building a building, you wouldn't say, oh, you know, safety codes and standards for electricity and plumbing are stupid. I don't need to be bothered to pay any attention to them. I would say, no, you need to pay enormous attention. Those standards reflect best practices of years of learning of what causes fires and what can burn a building down. And I think because legal and financial designs are sometimes, you know, they're relatively invisible. You can't walk up and kick them. We tend to not take them seriously. And particularly in the early days of crowdfunding, because there's so much concern about the changes, I think my concern is that entrepreneurs don't take the time to sit down and design the legal and capital structure with care, and then make sure it fits within all the laws and regulations of whatever jurisdictions they're operating under. So, if I could say anything, I would say take the time to get that design right, and take the time to find an attorney and make sure you are operating within the law, and I would say take the time to find the right portal. So this is all about who you know. So the right portal, the right attorney, and most importantly, the right crowd. Any comments, John?
No, that covers it.
Okay, investors. This is looking at it more from your and my point of view. Investors, my chief sort of message that I want to get to every investor is my expectation that is over the next year to 3 years, the crowdfunding volume is going to grow, and anybody who's known to be an investor, I think, is going to get overwhelmed by proposals. Now, if everything goes through portals, then that's going to sort of organize the flow a little bit more. If things really move outside the portals, particularly the sort of encouragement to come into the portal and look, I literally think whether your pad, your smartphone, your desktop computer, you're going to see investors overwhelmed with proposals. And those proposals are going to come through the internet, and they're going to They're going to come through the internet, and they're going to be very attractive, you know, and a lot of them are going to pull on your heartstrings. A couple things I would say to investors, one is don't be alone in this. If you can, you know, many investors doing private equity organize into angel networks, and angel networks are very powerful because you have people with knowledge about investments who help each other vet and do due diligence. For those of you who've never been in an angel network, you can jump on TV and watch Shark Tank. Gives you a little idea of what I would say a more predatory angel network might function like. I would say don't be alone, whether you have an angel network or we promote something called Celeri Circles, a circle. You really want a disciplined process of reviewing and vetting these kinds of proposals. That's number one. Number two, if you haven't listened to the Celeri report we did on entrainment and subliminal programming with Adam Trombley, I really encourage you to listen to this because I think there's going to be a segment of this world which is encouraged with those kind of fraudulent techniques. And so when you combine something that really looks like attractive, you know, cool, neatsy, keen entrepreneurs or technology, and it comes with that kind of technique, you can get talked into a lot of stuff. So I think have a disciplined process, have a group of people who help you stay disciplined, and please understand that that kind of technology exists and you need to make sure your knowledge of that and you protect yourself from it. I always say to investors who are interested in doing private equity or small business, you can only afford to invest that which you're prepared to lose 100%. I can see your face because John knows this well. Now, that doesn't mean don't do it. It's just saying, generally, I find unless you're talking about mature businesses who have a proven track record, and a proven track record not only of performing on their business, but performing for investors. You know, so they have a proven record of making money for investors and respecting the needs of their investors. I would say there are a couple situations where this is, in many respects, a more enlightened kind of philanthropy than philanthropy. One is there are going to be people in your family who are starting a business. And this gets back to building family wealth. And I encourage you, again, to listen to the Celeri report with Jay Hughes. But we've seen over many generations that families that pool their capital and help each other start and build businesses are the basis of not only building wealth, but building community wealth. And so so I think there is a tremendous opportunity for families to organize capital and help each other make their dreams come true. And over long periods of time, that's what builds the economic muscle of a company, and that's what builds great enterprises. And I think there's a real opportunity here to build family wealth. And you do that for strategic reasons. It's not just about making the fastest return on investment, because you're trying to build a successful family and a family with successful economic muscle. The second is strategic issues in your community. I am always saying to everyone who will listen, if we want to have a fresh food supply that we know is safe, we're going to have to finance it. There is no way that we can look to the corporate system for fresh food and be confident that it's safe. The system is completely broke. And if you look at the pressures on a corporate executive at this point, it is literally impossible for them to protect us from GMO food. So now if we want that capacity, we're going to have to finance it. And so we see, you know, growing and processing and distributing fresh food is one of those businesses that really can't be done 2,000 miles away. You cannot outsource that to Vietnam. It's got to be done nearby. So to me, there are some tremendous fundamental economics behind behind banking those businesses. Now, you can bank those businesses again with crowdfunding, with donations. You can bank them with pre-orders. As I said, we just did a term sheet. It's up on the blog of a food shop and processor that is raising money with non-voting shares and loans which convert at the option of the company into store credits. So Slow Money has a website, credibles.org. Take a look where you can. It's for food businesses that are financing itself with pre-orders. And but food is one. Another is the general businesses in your economic area. I can't tell you how many people I know who have prepared to live through hard economic times, and they've gotten off the grid, and they have a 1-year food supply, and they have all sorts of resources outside the banking system in case anything goes wrong. And after doing all this fantastic preparation, what they realize is, I have thousands of neighbors who haven't done that preparation. What is going to happen if we really come into hard economic times? What do we do? And that's when they realize we all have a vested interest in our community being successful economically and the other families being successful economically. And so I think one of the things we're going to see is a lot more coming together in circles or little groups, entrepreneurs together, saying, okay, how can we start to facilitate investment to rebuild the economic health of this place? I have everyone sort of across the country say, well, we have no money. And, you know, that's a little bit of a myth, because if you look at the money in any community, I live in a very poor community. If you look at the money going for illegal narcotics that are for something other than legitimate pain management, competing with the pharmaceuticals, and you look at what we're spending on the lottery, that is literally enough money to rebuild the whole economy. So if we just shifted over our unnecessary drug purse, if we stop getting high and we stop playing the lotto, we would have enough money to rebuild the entire economy, because microventure does not take a lot of equity. Of course, it also means we have to cut our TV time and use that time to build skills. But given the opportunities in the marketplace, with this new technology, it's there to be done, and we do have the capital, but it means we're going to have to shift time and money out of sort of non-productive activities and shift them back into productive activities. A couple of advice for both entrepreneurs, investors on the dark side of life. One of my biggest concerns about crowdfunding is we're going to encourage thousands of businesses to start up, to grow bigger, to take on new technology, to prototype a lot of the new technology that you and I talked about in our first conversation. And we're going to do it on a platform where the NSA is listening. And so imagine you're a small entrepreneur. You've got this new technology. You've figured something out. You're ready to start filing your patents. And of course, everybody's listening. And so you show up at the patent office and somebody else has stolen it and gotten there first. Or you've built your business to a very successful level and you're ready to sell out to, you know, a big company that is represented by a big investment bank, and they're listening on the phone, and so they know what price you're going to take, and they figure out how to jaw you down. Or if you, one of the movies we've recommended on the Solaria Reports is called Startup.com. It's the story of entrepreneurs who got hit by a covert op, their stock value dropped, and they got picked up for a song. So those are examples. I once had someone whose brother became a consultant to do mergers and acquisitions in New York to advise, and they worked with the big investment banks to help them pick up small companies. Their job was to get hired by the small company, get the inside information, give it to the investment bank so they could pick them up cheap. So you have this whole world of dirty tricks that are significantly more dangerous because we now have a telecommunications infrastructure where they are listening. So another, let me just run through it. The three movies I would suggest you watch is The Listening, which has been on, let's go to the movies on the Solari Report, that gives you a sense of how invasive this technology is. A second one is antitrust, another great example. And an example where you're talking about very powerful, economically powerful technology. And then finally, startup.com. So I would really encourage you go out and think about, okay, how am I going to do this in an operation where I don't have the kind of privacy? I'm dealing with predatory parties who are very invasive. I don't have the kind of privacy. How do I make sure that my intellectual capital is protected and not harvested? And that's one of my chief concerns, as you know, about this process. Now, some businesses, they don't care. I had one great entrepreneur say to me, look, there's no way they can track more than 20,000 situations. It would take enormous manpower. Wrong. They have computers. They have artificial intelligence. They've been working on this stuff for decades. So the ability for them to draw out through computers and artificial intelligence the most juicy piece of your conversation and use that whether to trade you and your inventions and your patents or to trade, you know, to use that information to trade a variety of things. You know, I can't tell you how many people I know who get laid off, get home, and within 24 hours, they've got, offers from the big banks for 30% interest rate credit cards. Or, you know, they talk on the telephone, I have a headache. And the next thing you know, within 24 hours, they're getting emails offering all sorts of remedies for headaches. So this system is very economic in terms of its ability to harvest at a micro level and at batch it and use it to trade the markets at a macro level. So just be warned and be careful. Be careful about the hype and be careful about the sort of techniques on the other side. And that's why John and I spent so much time talking about the bigger picture, because we want you to see some of the agendas here. I think, John, of crowdfunding as a window that's going to open, and it's going to let a lot of water that's been hidden behind or been building behind the dam flow through. And that's a good thing. It's going to help us shift to what I call the planetary debt for equity swap. We're going to shift out of the debt model and much more into equity model. I see that as a very positive. So the window's opening and all sorts of people have a variety of agendas. But I think what I would say is for a lot of investors and entrepreneurs, we can use this for our agenda as well.
There'll be positive and there'll be negatives. And,
right.
And obviously you're focusing on the positives, but some of the negatives would be it's going to be hyped and
right.
Some people are going to fall for some of the hype.
Right. Right. There's no doubt about it. So if this looks like the tech bubble, you just have to get out your surfboard and you have to know. So hopefully the entrepreneurs raise their capital before the bubble bursts and the investors sell their stock before the bubbles burst. Anyway, okay, well, that's it. Entrepreneurs and investors, there's a lot more to say, but we really need to wait and see what the regulations say. They're expected in the winter. We have a wonderful, very talented attorney leading position in venture capital, very experienced in venture capital and private equity, who's agreed that they're going to come on and we're going to talk about crowdfunding. We're going to have a second Solari Report on crowdfunding once the regulations come out. So stay tuned for that Solari Report as soon as the SEC promulgates its regulations again, expected to be in the winter, maybe by some say October, some say December. So let's just see. But in the meantime, we can all get prepared. We can all get knowledgeable about this, particularly if it's something that we're going to use as an entrepreneur or invest in as an investor. I just want to say a couple words. If you're a subscriber and you're thinking, well, I'm not going to use crowdfunding to raise money and I'm not planning in investing in private equity, so I'm not interested in these things. Is crowdfunding something that they ought to care about? Is crowdfunding something they ought to know about anyway?
Well, because of the wave that you're talking about, I mean, it's going to be a part of life, it looks like.
Right. I think this is going to be, this is going to have an effect on many things, whether on particular kind of industries, on particular kind of networks. I think it's going to affect communities. And so this is going to, as you know, it's like a flow of water that sort of percolates up and starts.
What concerns me, and I know we covered this in the first report, is that it bears many similarities to the internet bubble. And a lot of people were burned by that.
Right. Well, it bears, any time you see an explosion of technology, we see huge sort of bubble up in the stock market. That's what the 20s was. The Roaring 20s was a telecommunications and other technology bubbling up. And then we had the internet bubble. And of course, now we've got a similar kind of burst of technology and equity flowing into it. And so one of the things I want to stress to everyone as to the general impact is I think this is going to tremendously accelerate the exploration and adoption of new technology. So whether it's building out the digital heartland, whether it's integrating this kind of technology into our homes, our highways, our everyday life, whether it's reinvigorating manufacturing in the United States, whether it's a company that's doing it or just your 10-year-old making his own toys on his new 3D printer, whatever aspect of it is, it's going to accelerate change in very phenomenal and dramatic ways. And that change can really, you know, when we've had a lot of change, and I think some people are sort of overwhelmed by the change, this is going to accelerate it. You know, if you're expecting things to come back to normal, get ready for the opposite to happen. The other thing is we have a whole world of people in the legacy systems expecting collapse. Well, get ready for boom. You know, there is a part of the economy that's going to be absolutely booming. And I think if I could encourage you, you know, get some deck chairs out of the Titanic and get over to boom, you know, and start doing something because, you know, there are scenarios here where it ain't going to collapse. It's going to boom. So, you know, this thing could go many different ways. And I would just, as one dear friend of mine says, we're willing. You know, we're willing for this to work out. Okay, John.
Catherine, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you, investors, entrepreneurs, and all of us interested in where the world is going. Get ready, get ready, get ready. Crowdfunding is coming. Have a great day.